Well, let's welcome back manager Chris Coast. Chris, do you have any team updates for us?
There's a few, you know, minimal transactions, I guess. We brought in a new backup catcher to Dylan Kelly. In fact, Dylan Kelly had been on the injured list. We reactivated him, brought in a younger backup named Nick Kale from the Brewers organization, so he'll catch a little bit. We activated Tyler Wilson from the injured list, and hopefully he gives us strong stability at the end of the bullpen, which we really need. It's one of the areas where we've kind of come up short is stability in the bullpen. So Tyler Wilson hopefully gives us that extra inning late in the game if we can get some leads. So those are really the big additions to this point.
Well, let's jump into fan questions, and we'll start with Greg, who says, Chris, let me ask you about Sunday's game. You had the shift on for Kyle Martin, and it looks like a perfect defense as he grounds it right to Trey Hare, excuse me. But the ball takes a stupid bounce off the outfield lip. What is that like for you when you do all the things right and that doesn't work out for you?
It's part of the game. You know, it's funny because they say that, oh, you know, over the course of the season, things like that even out. And of course, players don't always believe that kind of thing. Like you hit a ball hard, you make an out, you hit a blooper, you get a hit to even out. And sometimes they even out, sometimes they don't. That was obviously some bad luck, and our record, I think at this point, we're 7-15, give or take, and we haven't played particularly well. The ball has not bounced our way. That was kind of indicative of our season to a certain point, and that's not an excuse by any means. Our record isn't a statement of bad luck. We haven't been playing very well consistently this year, but that was also an example of the way our season's going. So in some ways, I try to keep it humorous, like, you know, that's kind of the way things are going. At the same time, we're not giving ourselves that excuse of it's all bad luck, because we simply do need to play better. But I tried to find a way to laugh at it, because what else can you do? You know, you can only get mad so many times. So I try to laugh it off a little bit.
Trevor would like to know, the bullpen is really struggling. Are you losing your faith in them?
It's not so much losing faith in them. We came into the season where our guys maybe just weren't quite as stretched out as they would have been in a normal season, and that goes for the starters as well. So instead of starters going six innings potentially, you know, pitch counts got up on us pretty quick, and so had to use bullpen guys sooner in games than we'd have liked for multiple innings, and then they needed multiple days off because of it, because they maybe hadn't been quite as prepared as they would have been. And that led to some performance issues. You know, we got, you know, Brent Jones is a great example of a guy who was amazing for us last year, but he had a very defined, specific role of one inning in the seventh or eighth inning. And this year we had to push him out there for multiple innings, which is just not what his strength is, but we had no choice because we didn't have guys available on certain days. And then that led to Brent Jones also not being available for 2 days after that. So we've been kind of playing with a bullpen that wasn't at full strength, and maybe some ability issues, but more so I was not able to really put them in the best positions, unfortunately, to do what they do best. But now we're at the stage, hopefully, where that'll change. Our bullpen now on paper looks pretty strong, at least durable, and should be able to get more out of them. So we're looking for, you know, here it is, it's creeping up on August, and we have a few more games until August rolls around. That's kind of the goal, is now we have things lined up, looking for a much stronger August. And so I haven't lost confidence in the bullpen whatsoever. It's now I have more confidence knowing that they are now physically in a position to succeed. Now our offense has to do their job, get us some leads into the sixth inning, which we also haven't been doing a great job of either, is giving us leads in the sixth inning. So that's really where we're at. So no, I haven't lost confidence. If anything, it's the other way around.
Awesome. Connor would like to know, he says, Chris, I just want to start by saying that managing under these circumstances must be a nightmare, and thank you for doing this. This is probably a tough question to answer, but if you see someone out there who is an upgrade over a player you have, how do you assess the risk of a potential COVID carrier with the need of the team?
You know, that person being a potential COVID carrier, our worry isn't that person's going to give it to the rest of the team, because if they come in, they have to get tested. They wouldn't be around the team until they come back with a negative. So really the risk of bringing in a new guy is you can't just bring in that guy immediately. He has to sit around and wait for results to come back. And then you also have to weigh the concept of, even if that guy on paper is a better player, is he better right now? Is it going to take him 10 games to get his swing down? Or is his arm, if he's a pitcher, is his arm where he needs to be? Because that's kind of what we've seen. We've seen in this league so far some players who maybe don't have the most amazing past be amazing this year because they are incredibly ready. They had a facility to practice and play and get live at bats or throw live bullpens. And on the flip side, you see some guys with some amazing track records that have taken a little bit longer to get on track because either they didn't think there was a season, so they maybe weren't as ready, or they really relied on that March, April, and early May to get ready for our normal 100-game season. So to bring in a new guy has never been more risky. But once again, it's not so much for the health issues. It's, are they in fact ready? Do they have a facility to have practiced at? And we're dealing with the shortened season. We only have, I think, 38 games, give or take, to where we don't have a lot of time for guys to spring training themselves while we're trying to beat a team like Winnipeg. It's a tough scenario to beat it, but as far as it being a nightmare season to manage it, I would not use that word necessarily, just because even in the toughest of times, we've dealt with some tough times. You know, there's times where Winnipeg flat out embarrassed us on the field, where they ran wild and they got hits and they outpitched us and Rick Forney outmanaged me. I mean, there's all kinds of different things. But when I go home and I feel disappointed, or I can't wait to get back to the ballpark, I realize that we're still getting to play baseball. Things are going to get better. That the best managers and coaches I had in the past always reminded us when we were players of, when you're going good, you're never as good as you really think you are. And when you're going bad, you're not nearly as bad as you think you are. You're always somewhere in the middle. So that's a reminder I got to give our guys, that once again, this month of August coming up, on paper, things are starting to line up at this point. No excuses. We simply have to play better. So for me, it's a gift to still be able to do this.
You know, Chris, I don't think I've asked anybody this. So you bring in a guy, he's got to wait a week or 10 days before he's eligible to come. Is he given some kind of like injured reserve or something? So he's technically your player, but you're not using a roster spot.
Yeah, and so it's not quite that long of a duration to be on a COVID list or a wait list. It's, for example, like if I could get a message out there to all agents who have players who want to play in our league, they should be trying to get tested wherever they live. Because if a guy from, let's say, Wisconsin wants to play and he has access to get tested, and we want him, and he says, you know what, I just got tested on Friday, on Sunday I got the results back, I'm negative, he's good to go. He just has to come in and get what we call a rapid test to make sure in between nothing went wrong, and then he'd be eligible to play. It's more so the guys who haven't been tested have to come to Fargo, then get tested, and then wait for the results. Initially it took 2 days to get the results back, but now with the influx of tests, it's taking sometimes 4 days to get those negative test results back. So it's not a terribly long time, but there is a wait. It's no longer are the days where you sign a guy, he flies in, and all of a sudden he's pitching the seventh inning at 9 p.m. It's, you know, it was so far this year, that just can't happen.
David says, Skipper, what can some of these new sabermetric stats tell you about a player's success or potential success?
At our level, or the way we have things, is we have limited information. We have limited video and those kind of stats. Sabermetrics are going to be a little bit tougher to apply. I'm a believer in sabermetrics within reason, if it makes sense. You know, like, for example, shifting is a little bit tougher at our level because you have to go by basically what you see and what you have seen. So you take a Kyle Martin, we've seen enough of him last year and this year to know that we got to put some form of a shift on. But there's other guys that you don't know, whereas in the major leagues, you can take a look at Joey Gallo's last 1,000 at-bats and have immediate percentages of where he hits the ball on the ground, and you just put your guys there. We don't have that kind of information necessarily, so you have to go on memory and a little bit of data keeping yourself, whether you keep a spray chart, you know, things like that. And sometimes you get unlucky because you brought up the Kyle Martin where it hit the lip of the infield and bounced over Trey Harris' head. He also cue-balled one to the third base side where we didn't have a guy, and of course makes the shift look bad. In fact, a lot of fans were unhappy, like, that's why you don't shift. So sabermetrics are definitely applicable. You just have to have enough of that information to apply it. So whether you're talking launch angle, exit velocity, it doesn't really apply with us because we are not scouting our players. We are bringing our players in to win. That's the thing. It's like a guy can have all the sabermetrics data, but at the same time, our guys need to perform it and help us win ball games.
We have a couple of questions from Jack about catching. The first is, being a former catcher, what do you look for in a catcher who leads your pitching staff?
Number one, the understanding of what pitching really is and how important it really is. A catcher and the other players too, but more so the catchers, have to realize that there's no more important person on the field than the pitcher. He's the most important guy at all times until he releases the ball. Once he releases the ball, then, you know, all bets are off. But nobody's more important than that pitcher because they impact the game directly more than anybody else every night. So that, and then the importance to understand what your pitchers can do, and then that leadership. And that's why we love, like, Dylan Kelly is so valuable for any team he plays for, because even when he's not getting a hit, even when he's not necessarily throwing runners out, his energy level, his intent to win, his intent to get the most out of his pitchers and in some ways be a cheerleader and making sure that when their confidence starts to falter, he's able to get it back up. And then also the pitchers know that Dylan Kelly is never taking a pitch off. Every single pitch for him is the single most important pitch of the game at that point in his energy level. And so that's, you know, you want your catchers to be good players. You want them to get hits. You want them to throw runners out. But all the other things that go into it, catching is so important. And I've seen countless times over the course of my career the impact that a really strong, positive catcher can have on a pitching staff. And not all pitchers. Some pitchers, it doesn't matter who's catching. They just get it done. But there's a lot of pitchers who need a catcher to help them out, especially in the big spots. And so you do want your leadership, but more than anything, you want your pitchers to know that your catcher absolutely loves them and cares and would take a sword for them if that's what it took.
I think Vinny DeFazio, who caught for the Saints like 5 years ago, told me once he was 40% catcher, 60% psychologist.
No. Yeah, absolutely. And that's the way that I felt. That's why I think managers, the highest percentage of managers had been catchers, because you deal with all parts of the game, but the psychology of being a catcher, and you have to be able to also be a good poker player as far as reading your pitcher and seeing signs and things like that. So there's a crazy amount of stuff that goes into being a good catcher.
Jack, along those lines, I'd like to know, what do you want your catcher to do if a pitcher seems resistant to attacking hitters?
That's where the trust factor has to come in. If a catcher has to go out there and basically say, you have to trust your stuff, remember what you do best. In fact, as a manager, that's what we remind our pitchers all the time, is you have to remember what you do best, because you can pitch to the hitter's weakness, but if you don't have the ability to attack that weakness, you still have to resort back to what you do best. So the seed that we try to plant in all of our pitchers' heads is, when things are rough and you don't know what to do, everybody has their own phrase that they have to say in their head. What do I do best? And sometimes it's just, I throw fastballs away for strikes. Sometimes it is, I can throw my breaking ball whenever I want, or I can pitch inside, you know, things like that. So there's these catchphrases that catchers have to make sure that they get their pitchers back to, because once again, it's every pitcher is different. Some have just a ton of weapons they can go to. Some have limitations. But they all have a particular strength that they have to get to when times are tough, and that's where a catcher has to come in to remind them of what. If you're going to get beat, make sure you get beat with your best stuff and your best plan of attack. You don't want to get beat with your third or fourth best pitch, because that's when you lose sleep. If you throw your best pitch and the hitter hits it, you have to be able to live with it. We can sleep at night. You can't get beat with less than your best stuff.
Vic says, my son's coach was telling him he needs to improve his eye at the plate. How do you do that?
That is an incredibly tough thing to do. In fact, it's one of those, it's almost a gift. Like, you look, take a Brennan Metzger. He has just an amazing eye at the plate. He will strike out looking a little bit, but a lot of it's because he has such a good eye that he's not swinging at a pitch unless it's right where he wants it to be, and he's willing to accept the results. And so, to improve your eye at the plate is really tough. The only thing you can do is, if you have a pitching machine for high velocity, to train your eye at higher speeds, so when you're in a game, the ball seems to slow down, you can judge the strike zone better. I mean, there's so many, it's, some of it's physical, some of it's mental. I'll say this about me and my career. When I was at my best, I was willing to swing and miss at pitches that weren't strikes because I knew that was what I had to do to succeed over the course of 140 or 160 games. I was willing to swing at a slider in the dirt on the first pitch because it meant that I was ready for a fastball because at some point the pitcher was going to make a mistake. I was ready for it. But not everybody or other people have better gifts. So at certain points, when you're younger, you can still refine your skills. You can still work on things and get better. But once you get to a certain age, yes, you can improve things to a certain extent, but by the time you're in your 20s, you're kind of the hitter that you could be. You can improve your eye to a certain extent, but when I got into trouble at the higher levels is when I tried to improve my eye at the plate. It never worked for me. So there's a phrase that the Dominicans always say is swing the bat because you can't walk your way off the island. So having an eye at the plate is really, really important, but at the same time, you can't get anywhere just taking walks. You still, even Brendan Metzger will put the ball over the fence on occasion. So you still have to be dynamic and ready to swing because I know I've gotten kind of long with this answer, but it's, to me, it's been really important is you have to be ready to hit. You can't be ready to take pitches. You have to be ready to hit to succeed. When guys are, when you get to the level where guys are throwing 90, and actually nowadays 95, a lot of guys are over 95 miles an hour. If you're up there to not be ready to swing, you have no chance. You have to be ready to swing the bat.
There's no brevity to good advice, Chris. I just want to say that right now. Gerald would like to know, what do you think of all of these unwritten rules like beaning a guy who hit a home run, no bat flips, and stuff like that?
This is a tough one because the baseball world is full of there's plenty of guys who, the alpha male, tough guy, don't want to be shown up. I get it, and all that stuff, things like that. But a lot of it has to do, to me, it's like two things. Like when a guy steals a base late in the game when the game's already out of hand, you know, why? You ask yourself, why is he doing that? Is he doing it to pad his stats? Is he doing it because he still thinks he's trying to help his team win a game? Or when a guy drops on a bunt when the game is seemingly out of hand, or things like that. The showboating, it's become more of a part of the game. It's if a pitcher gives up a 500-foot homer, I'm not condoning a hitter throwing a bat or doing cartwheels around the bases, but at the same time, we are individuality to a certain extent should be encouraged. We're not robots. If I'm a pitcher and I give up a home run, I absolutely don't want the hitter to stand there and watch it. It angers me, but I'm also not going to start throwing at guys because then you're at risk of your guys also being thrown at. The unwritten rules to me are once again, two things. Is the guy being selfish, or is he doing it to humiliate the other team? Then we get into some gray areas. So I'm not a big believer in just hitting guys for no reason whatsoever, because once again, the other issue I have with pitchers throwing at hitters is most pitchers are not very good at it. And they try to hit a guy like, you know, right in the backside or right in the ribs. That's what the catchphrase is. I'm going to get them right in the ribs. Well, inevitably what happens is they're not totally committed to hitting the guy, so the ball elevates and it goes right near the head, which is why things always look bad. So, and at that point, like, even if the pitcher is seemingly in the right to throw at a guy, but then the second that ball goes near the head, all bets are off. Now the pitcher's at fault. And so there's just too many things that can go wrong and turn things, and all of a sudden there's unnecessary fights and things that just don't make anybody right. Because in the world of baseball, nobody is ever actually right. Nobody has ever been hit and said, okay, well, yeah, you were right. You know, it's like, it's just, all it does is throw fuel in the fire. So I'm not saying there's never a time for it. I'd rather there never be a time for it, but there is. There's times where a guy's crossed the line, but at the same time, you still have to try to get guys out. I would rather strike a guy out myself than try to hit a guy. But I'll go back to this and I'll say this again. Pitchers typically, even though they don't want to admit it, are not really good at hitting guys. And inevitably they miss. They'll miss 2-3 times in a row. And they'll go towards the head. And it's rarely ever a really positive situation because all it does is make everybody mad. It makes everybody want to fight. And it takes away, from the actual respects of the game. But, I guess I could go on hours on this topic, really.
You know, I wondered, hearing that, as a pitcher, you see these guys can, hit a, you know, the bottle cap off of a log, you know, at 60 feet away or whatever. But psychologically, you spent all of this time saying, don't hit this guy. And then all of a sudden, that's what you're asking your brain to tell you to do. That must be kind of a hard conflict to overcome.
Yeah, no question. And it's, like I said, it's your anger, and maybe you want to hit a guy, but all of a sudden, you know, the guy can move out of the way. You're trying to pick a spot, and it's a whole different psyche and mentality when you're trying to. And some guys are. I've played with guys who, if they wanted to hit a guy right in the ribs, they would absolutely be able to do it. But even the guys with control sometimes have a hard time doing it. And once again, it's like when they miss, a lot of times they miss up by the head, not on purpose, but that's inevitably when they're unsure. The ball kind of sails off their fingers a little bit. And when a ball goes by a guy's head and sails to the backstop, it's a really bad look. And all of a sudden, you go from being in the right to being the bad guy in the snap of a finger, and now everybody's mad. And then, not to mention, I've been on plenty of situations from either side to where the second that pitcher throws up near someone's head, his own teammates are mad at him because now they know they are at risk when they come to the plate against the opponent. So, once again, there's so many things that can go wrong in these scenarios.
Interesting. Steve says, Chris, piggybacking off your comments from last week, with teams so focused on how hard someone throws, do you feel like the art of pitching has been lost?
It is starting to get lost, yes. It's not lost because, once again, baseball will adjust. Baseball will find a way. With power arms being such a big deal right now, that over time, and it won't take very long to where these power arms, when they're, you know, these young kids that are stronger, throw harder, they're going to also learn to pitch. So I got to believe in 5 to 7 to 10 years. If you look at where the game of pitching is going to be in 2030, I know that seems like it's a million years away, but it's 10 years away. The pitching is going to be absolutely absurd. It's going to be, you're going to see guys throwing 98 on a regular basis and being able to pitch. It's going to be incredible. The other night, if you watch Kyle Hendricks pitch for the Cubs, it was absolutely amazing watching him do his thing. He's 86 to 89, and that ball is moving in every different direction, nothing to straight. When they put the K-zone up there, he's hitting absolutely every quadrant and angle. It's just like you're going to start seeing more of Kyle Hendricks, but guys like Kyle Hendricks are also going to be throwing 93, 94. It is, so with the power arms, listen, I love to look at a radar gun and see a guy throw a 99. I think that's pretty amazing, but at the same time, at some point, you still have to be able to throw strikes. You still have to be able to fool hitters or be unpredictable. It's not so much about fooling hitters. You have to be unpredictable, and that's where a guy like our closer, Mitchell Osnowitz, has gotten to that stage where he can throw 97 to 99, but he's also learned to become unpredictable. He can throw a slider or curveball at various points and keep hitters honest because, and I might have used this example last week, Mitchell Osnowitz threw a pitch to Roy Morales at 99 miles an hour. It was the first pitch. And Roy Morales hit it to the right center for a double off a 99 mile fastball. So, yes, pitchers still need to be able to be unpredictable.
Brandon says, the Phillies got beat up a little this weekend, Chris. Cause for concern about the pitching staff?
Anytime that you lose games with your bullpen, especially, it can be disheartening. And, you know, with the Red Hawks, we've had that situation a little bit, but at the same time, you have to have trust that the guys out there will figure it out. It's hard to replace guys with, I mean, you already have your bullpen full of guys who you think are your best guys in the major league, so to replace them with someone else can be a risky situation. So this early in the season, for the major leagues, there's really no cause of concern in almost any regard, with the exception of you have to make sure your bullpen gets it figured out, because when you have a lead into the seventh or the eighth and you lose games with your bullpen or your bullpen gets knocked around, that can be tough to come back from on a regular basis, because what happens the next night when you have a lead in the seventh inning, that trust factor. I know that question was asked to me earlier in this segment, but once again, with the Phillies, their bullpen, they're going to score some runs. When you have Bryce Harper, JT Realmuto, and the other guys they have in there, they're going to score some runs. So they have to have some bullpen who can, from the sixth to the ninth inning, you got to be able to shut some things down, because the Phillies can win a lot of games if their bullpen is good. In fact, I look back to the 2007, 2008 Phillies when we were winning division titles, and in 2009 as well. Our bullpen was, they weren't, in 2008, our bullpen was not supposed to be that good. It's just, they all happened to have career years, and it was amazing. And we ended up winning the division, winning the World Series, and so on and so forth. So you cannot win without a strong bullpen.
Jacob says, I've really been trying to write a book, but I'm finding it is difficult to do. What's the hardest part that you found about writing one?
Well, for me, it was different because I knew I had a story to tell. I knew that baseball people might be interested in it, things like that. So for me, the writing of it wasn't overly tough. It was just long, you know. And so I was actually had a lot of fun doing it because when I was writing my book, I was reliving all these amazing memories. So for me, it was the writing part was great. I had told my story plenty of times to where when I was writing it, I wrote it as if I was telling it or giving a speech or doing an interview. So in that regard, it made it a little bit easier. For me, the toughest part was the editing process because what I think might be interesting may not always be the case. And things that what I found out was things that I didn't think were as interesting, other people, in fact, did find interesting. So that's where editing it yourself and then also having editors comes in. But that was tough because as much as I loved my own story because I lived it, after having reread it about 50 times at 220 pages, give or take, I got sick of my own story after a while. So it was that was, for me, the editing process. But it depends on what you're writing about. If you're writing about yourself, it should be a little bit easier. I wrote about myself, so it was easy. But if I were to write a documentary about something that, if I was writing about something that I wasn't experienced with, there's no chance I could write a book.
Awesome. Henry asks, he says, Skipper, do you think that it is ironic that there are so many ways that people can communicate with one another, and yet people are struggling with being isolated because of the lack of human interaction?
That's an interesting one. In fact, the lack of human interaction, especially crowd, was something I didn't really realize until opening day in Fargo, because we had, I think, right around 2,100 people, which is what we were allowed opening day, and our stadium holds just under 5,000, so half capacity. But since no one had been around each other or around crowds, 2,000 people felt like it was a million people. It was pretty incredible. As much as technology changes the world with cell phones and text messaging and social media and Zoom meetings, all that stuff can be pretty cool, but there'll never be a substitute for actual human interaction with family, with close friends. That's the thing. It's like you can keep in contact with people and stay friends, but when you have a true best friend or family, sons, daughters, moms, dads, there's no substitute for actually being in person, maybe sharing a Budweiser on occasion with your best friend, whatever the situation may be. So staying in touch with technology is important, but at the same time, no matter how technology changes the world, being in person with people who you love or best friends with, that'll never change.
Brian would like to know, what was it like the first time you saw your Major League Baseball card, and do you have one of your own?
Yeah, I was fortunate to have a ton of different types of baseball cards, but my favorite one was, in fact, my first one. The reason why was because it was so indicative of my career. It's a picture of me playing first base. It says on the card that I'm a third baseman, and in fact, I was a catcher. So that's why it was my favorite card, because that was kind of one of the reasons why it took me so long to get to the major leagues, is people were not totally sure what position I was best at. And you don't have your backup catcher in the major leagues being a utility guy. He is, in fact, a catcher. So that's where the confusion was. So the fact that my baseball card is me playing first base, it says I'm a third baseman, and I was a catcher, was like it was the epitome of my career. It was perfect. I wouldn't change it any other way. But I still get cards in the mail, whether it's at my school or at my college that I coach at or Red Hawk Stadium. Almost every day I get an envelope of cards, and I look forward to signing it, because when you're a player, you get so many cards in the mail to sign, and when you're not a player anymore, you kind of miss that. So the fact I still get cards in the mail to sign is pretty cool.
That's awesome. And we end this week with Sarah, who says, Chris, just wanted to say thank you for all that you and the players go through to give us baseball this summer. We love you guys.
Well, that's awesome to hear. We want to hear more of that because it's one of those situations where we get caught up in the wins and losses, and especially when you're not doing real well as a team, you get caught up in the losses. And it's been tough this year with fans because we're not allowed to interact with the fans. We're not allowed to sign autographs. We're not allowed to throw baseballs in the stands. And for me, that's incredibly tough because even during these tough times, if I was able to sign autographs, mingle with fans, it's always been one of my favorite things to do. Is when I was a hitter on deck, I would always talk with the fans in the area in the first couple of rows, regardless of what stadium I was at. It's just one of those things to, sign an autograph. So the fact that we still have fan support, we don't get the firsthand experience like we had in the past. So hearing comments like that is awesome. And I'm ecstatic that we get to play baseball, but I really look forward to the day where we can get back to, if I field a foul ball over in the third base coaching box, I want to be able to throw it to the 10-year-old standing 10 feet away behind the fence with a glove on. That's what minor league baseball is known for. It's what it's all about. And so once again, I appreciate that comment. We do need reminders that the fans care. Players want to play in front of fans. Yes, in the minor leagues, you have your career to think about, and that's what they're trying to do. But players, everybody will tell you they would much rather play in a packed stadium full of fans who care than not care. That's why even if fans are booing, at least they care. So the fact that we get a comment like that, I'd love to hear more of that.
That's awesome. Chris, thanks for joining us this week.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Talk to you next week.